Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. It's Questions Day. We do have, as we hoped, one big news story to bring you very quickly, I think. But also, Kieran, it's unusual for us, but we need to start with an apology arising out
Indeed.
Of our last podcast. We were talking about the new Cristiano Ronaldo NFT range backed by a cryptocurrency, which I, because of an autocorrect error in the script, I referred to as the bin face. I said this currency was called the bin face. You corrected me, but we decided to carry on calling it the bin face anyway, because we thought it was a better name for a cryptocurrency. And then we speculated whether it actually had the blessing of Count Binface, the wonderful independent space warrior and political activist. And we then got a lovely message from said Count Binface to say that he was a big, big fan of the pod, but could we please point out that he had nothing to do with the wrongly named cryptocurrency that's backing Cristiano Ronaldo's NFT, because he didn't approve of that sort of thing, and of course couldn't endorse anything where it was possible to lose so much after spending so little. So we are happy to make that correction. Count Binface had nothing to do with the mistaken cryptocurrency that we talked about. It wasn't called Binface in the first place, but it made me laugh very much, his message. I'm only too happy that of all the people that we've got, Lawrence Bassini, we've never apologised to him. So there's all sorts of people we've never, Steve Dale, no chance for, but Count Binface, only too happy to make that apology.
Yes, and if the Count is listening, if you want to come on to the show and to tell us about the Binface manifesto for football, because we appreciate that we have reached out to politicians from other parties. We've had both Labour and Conservative politicians on the show. So in the spirit of inclusivity, and also the chances are that you will bring less shame to the game than some of our elected members of Parliament, we'd love to have you on the show.
We absolutely would, yes. Any political candidate whose policies include renaming London Bridge Phoebe Waller Bridge, nationalising Adele, and proroguing Jacob Rees-Mogg is fine by me. Our first news story, Kieran, oh happy day, oh frabjous day. It seems, finally, 100% definitely, that Derby County are now safely in the hands of a new owner who seems like a sensible person, who's followed us on Twitter, and more importantly, owns the ground as well. So it's been a long time, Kieran, but hopefully this is it now, isn't it?
The administrators have sold the assets of Derby County Football Club. In addition, the stadium has been sold in a separate transaction from one of Mel Morris's companies to David Clowes. The EFL have given approval. So there's lots of positives. Fans can now focus on moaning about season ticket prices and pie prices, and slagging off the team at 5 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon to the local radio station, which is what football is all about. So it is good news. It's taken a long time. It's taken too long a time.
Yeah.
Certainly the initial press release from David Clowes is a very positive one. From the ferreting around that I've done, he didn't want to do this in particular. He's a man that values his privacy, and that's something which you potentially lose as the owner of a football club. But the alternative, which was the real danger of losing Derby County altogether, was too great. So congratulations to him. We wish him all the best. There's a few unusual issues, I think, which hopefully will be resolved in due time. Certainly from speaking to some national journalists, from reading articles, it looks as if the total price paid for both the stadium and the football club is somewhere in the region of £60 to £65 million. Mm. Now, that's very good news for unsecured creditors. That's very good news for HMRC. So, that is to be welcomed. But I look at that and I say, well, that does seem, a very generous price. Mm. Because the stadium effectively went for £22 million. So, we're talking £38 to £40 million for what exactly? You had 5-7 players in contract and you wouldn't get big fees for them. So what else? Yes, you've got the name of Derby County. Yes, you've got a position in League One for next season. But Sunderland went for less than that. Mm. Ipswich went for less than that substantially. Yeah, we were talking fractions of these prices. So that needs perhaps a little bit more clarity, a little bit more transparency. It looks as if Stephen Pearce, who was Mel Morris's chief executive, is carrying on in the role. I think fans might feel a bit uncomfortable with that because again, for the sake of transparency, I've had communication with Stephen over the past couple of years. I've always got on well with him. I think it's fair to say that we agree to disagree, but we do so in a professional and polite manner about some of the issues in respect to the club. You would think that a new person might want to perhaps break from the old regime. I think we could do with pure openness, and hopefully we'll get that from Mr. Clowes. And I wish Liam Rossini, who is a person that I've met on a few occasions, and he's a very, very decent guy and a very progressive coach and manager. Yeah, wish him all the best for next season.
Yeah, let's not pour cold water into the champagne at this stage of the game, Kieran. Let them have at least a couple of weeks. I understand you had a rather touching message from the people at Radio Derby.
It was along the lines of it's not you, it's me, but we never want to hear from you again. I get that. I wasn't exactly it was sort of Radio Derby. Maguire's coming on the radio again, and at the same time they're giving out the phone number for the Samaritans. So it's not exactly good for my profile either. Also I've got to say that people like Ed Dawes at Radio Derby and Chris and people who I've got to know quite well, they have done all that they can. I know some fans have been frustrated with them. Some fans are still a bit sniffy. It doesn't bother me, but on the Derby fans forum, apparently they're blaming me and Rick Parry and Steve Gibson for the demise of the club, which I find a bit strange, because all that I did was write to the EFL and say I think there's something wrong here as far as the finances are concerned, and I think Mr. Morris isn't necessarily acting in the best long-term interests of the club. So, each to their own.
That's going to really annoy Mel Morris. He's spent all that time trying to make himself the villain of this piece, and you breeze in. It's just for today. I can't tell you how happy I am about the news. It's brilliant for Derby fans.
Yeah.
I shall miss them. There's a sort of Stockholm syndrome going on. I feel that Derby kidnapped us about 18 months ago, and then over the piece as hostages we've sort of slightly fallen in love with them a little bit, so let's not talk about Derby for quite some time. Although I suspect Quantumar's name might crop up every now and again even if it's only on a letter from their solicitors, but there you go. Let's get into the questions, and the first one comes from Adam Bennett. And Adam Bennett's question reflects that a lot of people listening to this pod are fairly obsessed with ways of getting around FFP and how other clubs are doing it. And Adam Bennett says, my question is about new stadium spending in relation to FFP, specifically money spent on groundwork before planning permission for Everton's new stadium. I've heard that the club spent around £50 million on the site, pre-build works, consultations and applications, and that this money went down on the books as spend. Now that planning permission has been granted as work has started, this spend will now turn into capital on the books and in turn add £50 million onto the books to help with FFP. Is this true? Or if not, how does stadium build with FFP actually work? It's a topical question, Kieran, as we heard this week that Burnley, now acting on their own, are still intent on asking the Premier League to investigate how Everton was spending so much money and not breaching FFP rules. And it does look as well that Everton are in the business of selling players this summer rather than buying them. They brought Tarkowski in, but they're losing Richarlison and a couple of other big assets.
Yes. With regard to what Everton have done, first of all, in 2019-20, and this was prior to planning permission being granted, they spent around about £20 million on pre-work. Architects, surveyors, looking at the land. I think it was at the area in which the stadium is being built, Bramley Moor Dock. I think there's a bit more sand there than they would have liked, so they started to sort of do some pre-work there. I was at work earlier this week at the University of Liverpool. And I caught a train because we had an away day at Anfield, which didn't go down well with the Everton supporting elements of the department, as you can imagine, all of whom decided to turn up in their Everton shirts and tracksuits just to get the message. Okay, who made this decision? there's a few raised eyebrows. So I caught the train, I caught Merseyrail back, and you can see what's happening in terms of the new stadium. And a lot of progress is being made. So the £20 million which went through the books in 2019-20, that has gone through as a cost because you can't treat that expenditure as an asset until you've got planning permission. And that has been put through as a claim for FFP, and they're perfectly entitled to do that. It's perfectly within the rules. I don't see an issue there. With the work that's been undertaken since the granting of planning permission, that work will go into the overall cost of the new stadium. And none of that will hit against profits because it's treated as an asset rather than an expense. So therefore, it doesn't go into FFP. It's completely excluded. I'm a bit peeved with is actually UEFA here, because what UEFA have always done historically is to say that we will encourage what I describe as virtue spending. Virtue spending is spending on infrastructure, which improves facilities for fans and players if it's training facilities, spending on academy, spending on the women's team, spending on community activities. All of that is exempt from FFP. So that, I think that's fantastic. I think that's really progressive. And under UEFA's new rules, that expenditure is no longer going to be exempt from FFP. And you might say, well why is that? And you sort of say, is there something Machiavellian taking place here? Not that we're cynics, as we've said on many an occasion. And I think, well, hold on, this is going to make it more difficult for those clubs that want to grow, because now if you are going to build a new stadium with a view to increase capacity, to that help you to bring in the more money, that will allow you to compete against the established elite, that expenditure historically has been exempt from FFP. It will no longer be exempt from FFP, which means that ambitious clubs are going to find life a lot harder if they want to compete against the closed shop that is European football at present at the elite level. And also what UEFA have done is that the new financial fair play rules are going to be assessed from the 1st of January to the 31st of December, whereas historically they've been from June to June. So therefore you could always work out the numbers from the accounts. And you've got people like Swiss Ramble who do absolutely fantastic forensic analysis of this. They're just making life more difficult for people who want to scrutinize the clubs and who want to scrutinize UEFA itself, which is hugely disappointing.
I mean, also the potential knock-on effect there for women's football, just as one example, is worrying, isn't it, Kieran?
Mm. Yeah, because what we have seen is that if you take a look at the accounts of the WSL, and again, to be transparent, I'm talking at a conference today. We're recording this on Sunday, so I'm recording. Presenting to a conference on women's football later today. And one of the things is the sustainability of the women's game and how do we encourage investment. Well, clubs historically have been willing to accept that women's football is in a growth phase. All of the clubs are losing money. But take a longer term view. Yeah, we hope to grow the game, which is fantastic. And if the women's teams are losing money, at least that is exempt from FFP. Yeah. So yeah, we it's something we're willing to deal with. All of a sudden, that's now changed. And I appreciate that these are the UEFA rules and they don't apply to the FA. We don't know where, or sorry, they don't apply to the Premier League and the EFL clubs. I hope that. That clubs in the Premier League and clubs in the EFL, when they next come to a vote, decide to maintain the present position with regards to these things, which are, I think, is good for the greater good of the game.
Good. It's good to clarify that those UEFA rules don't yet apply to us. Great. Yeah. Our next question comes from John Lee. It's a simple one. John says, players are shown as assets, but what about coaching staff and the manager? Surely they have a value. What value would have been put on Alex Ferguson?
Right. Players do have a value, but as far as the accounts are concerned, we only show cost and not value. Mm. So therefore, if you take Harry Kane, Phil Foden, you know, Alexander Arnold, players of that calibre who are, you know, very high profile, they're internationals, because they've all come through the academy, they've come through at a zero cost. So therefore, there is nothing shown in respect of them as far as the accounts are concerned. When it comes to other players, what you do is that you capitalize, you show in the books the compensation paid for the player's registration, and that's spread over the registration period. Yeah, we go back to our old friend amortization. In respect of managers and coaches, that doesn't tend to be the norm. Okay, you know, you've got the likes of, if we go back to André Villas-Boas, who went from Porto to Chelsea, that was a compensation fee of £13.3 million. Now, in theory, Chelsea perhaps could have spread that over the life of the contract, except, of course, they sacked him within 6 months. So, yeah, that had gone. I know Brighton paid compensation to Swansea for Graham Potter. Could they spread that over the contract? I think conceptually they possibly could. But there's not that many managers who are going from club to club with large fees. And remember, the average shelf life of a manager is 2 years. Mm. So, you know, at most you'd be doing is spreading it over 2 years. So for the likes of Sir Alex, he left with the good wishes of the people of Aberdeen to go to Manchester United. I don't think Manchester United paid compensation for him at the time, so therefore there would have been nothing in the books. And it just goes to show that, you know, how nonsensical the accounts are, because they do show cost rather than value, and that's why they significantly undervalue clubs, because the biggest assets of the clubs, which, you know, clearly we've got the playing staff, but also things like the loyalty of the fan base and sort of the future hopes and fears and dreams of fans, it's impossible to put a number onto those.
Mm. Now, our next question comes from Stuart McKenzie McIntyre. Which is the name of the day. It's quite possible that Stuart McKenzie McIntyre lives in a bed sit in Ipswich, but I like to think he actually dictated this question to his gilly whilst he was doing a spot of fly fishing in a lovely, clear Scottish river. But wherever Stuart Mackenzie McIntyre is based, it's an interesting question. Bear with us because it's a slightly long one, but it's worth getting to the end of. Stuart Mackenzie McIntyre was thinking about Tracy Crouch. So you and he have a lot in common, Kieran. probably quite distracting.
I got a message from Tracy on Thursday, which if I took out all of the swear words, it probably had said, I did, and that's it.
And I believe the hashtag was winning at life, wasn't it?
you asked
her how a particular parliamentary committee had gone. That was very funny. But Stuart said he was thinking about Tracy Crouch's comments on a pod about the way the EFL had seen the direction matters were moving and the Premier League had not, just in terms of sustainability of the game, I believe Stuart's talking about there. As Stuart said, I was wondering if it would help the Premier League to focus their minds if the following could take place. Within any new legislation to be introduced on the back of the report, a new VAT product code and VAT charge, say 25%, on the fee to be paid for the registration of players' contracts at a Premier League club when the previous registration was at either another Premier League club or a non-UK club. The government could then use that additional VAT collected over the standard rate to provide grants to men's and women's grassroots football. Using VAT would also mean that the additional income is paid straight away, even when the transfer fee agreement allows for a spread of payments. So basically, Stuart's saying, could we charge Premier League clubs more VAT and spread that around? And then he says, as an aside, would Kieran know if most football clubs are net VAT payers or VAT refund receivers? So, of course, I've made a mental note to talk to Bobby Numbers tomorrow about the idea that there are VAT refund receivers. No one's told me that's possible. How can that? VAT is my bet noir, but I'm very much only ever been a VAT payer. But I think it's a really interesting question. If Stuart's saying if Tracy Crouch and the government are serious about this, then would it be possible to up the VAT rate on Premier League clubs and spread that money around?
It would be. I think it might set a precedent for other industries in terms of changing VAT rates, which could make things life just a bit more complicated. If, however, we go back to Tracy Crouch's fan-led review, and this is also something we've discussed with Gordon Brown, we've had a couple of conversations with him. Mm. Instead of having a separate VAT code, why not have a levy on transfers for clubs from the Premier League? And this has been suggested. So if Premier League clubs sign players from other Premier League teams, they have to pay a levy. If they sign players from overseas, they have to pay that levy. If they sign players from the Championship, they don't. So this would encourage more traffic potentially from EFL clubs to the Premier League, which would benefit them. The levy raised on intra Premier League transfer fees could go into grassroots, could go into sporting football. So that is something certainly which is on the radar of I think the people who are behind the proposals for the independent regulator. We have to see what happens as far as the white paper is concerned. At the same time, you and I we had a conversation earlier today, and the Premier League is doing all it can to deny, discredit, delay all progress through using lobbying agencies and by giving crumbs from the table in terms of some of the proposals of the fan-led review. So that's certainly worth considering. Secondly, with regards to Stuart's question in respect of are football clubs net payers or net in receipt, that they are very much net payers because they charge VAT on tickets, they charge VAT in terms of the broadcast deals, they charge VAT to their commercial partners, and of course they pay VAT in respect of transfer registrations as well. So that's all of the VAT money that they collect from their sales. Their biggest expenditure is wages, which are not part of VAT. So they are very much net payers. But if again we're looking to generate money, we've seen leaked, I think, to the press over the last 3 or 4 days. And you and I, we've had this discussion on the show a few times. The ban on front of shirt advertising is likely to evaporate. The proposals are likely to be watered down. Perhaps a voluntary ban, which there's simply not enough appetite for it. The gambling industry, I know people say, why have you got such a beef against the gambling? I've got no beef against the gambling industry if it behaves in an appropriate manner. But it doesn't, in my view, in with regards to its business practices. And that's what annoys me. But again, let's go back. The horse racing industry is funded via a betting levy. Football is the country's national sport. There is a very good case, in my opinion, for having a gambling levy on football bets, and that money then gets distributed. And in my view, you split it between the EFL and grassroots football, because those are the areas that we need most. That would help to address the issues of the imbalance in distribution of money, and if combined with better cost controls within the EFL, I think that could certainly make a difference. And I've crunched all the numbers. I've given them to, should we say, I've given them to people. I'll be honest, I've had a mixed response, because the gambling industry has a very, very strong voice and is very, very generous with its time and opportunities to people to listen to it.
Yes, two things arising from that, Kieran. Firstly, as we know, the attitude of most Premier League clubs, certainly the top six, top seven, top eight, towards an independent regulator is pretty much over my dead body. And what's worrying about the government, within a very short space of time, announcing their, they call it, important ban on shirt front advertising by gambling companies, have backed down in the face of pressure from gambling companies and Premier League clubs, who say, well, there's no one else who can afford the money we need to sponsor the front of our shirts. So that doesn't bode well for them standing up to the clubs who don't want an independent regulator. And secondly, you know, I ask this question more out of sorrow than anything else, Kieran. I don't understand VAT full stop. And last time I said that, people very kindly tweeted me with simple, and I still, it doesn't work. I don't understand it. But I understand even less the idea of VAT refund receivers. How does that even work, Kieran? Is that a business model?
No, it's not. It's a case of what do you do as your business. So if you were involved in energy, if you were involved perhaps I'm not a VAT expert. It's a long, long time since I saw it. But let's say that you're working as a school somewhere in education, you don't tend to charge VAT on your courses. So therefore, you're not collecting VAT from your customers, but you are still paying VAT because you're buying stationery, fuel. So the way that VAT works, it's worked on a net basis. It's the VAT that you collect from your sales less the VAT that you pay on your purchases. Now, if your sales are non-VATable, you're not collecting anything, but you're still incurring the cost. You're still paying the VAT yourself. So therefore, you put in and you get that money back. It is a system which has logic. If you Google, don't anybody do this if they've got any sense at all, if you Google VAT carousel fraud, unfortunately, that the system is targeted by fraudsters, just as we saw with the furlough scheme and other things during the pandemic. So it's a constant battle for HMRC to ensure that the right amounts are being paid. But you can end up actually with VAT refunds on a regular basis.
Well, why are people who are not charging VAT for their product even VAT rated then?
VAT registered. Well, the reason why you do it is because you do get money back. If I'm buying If I'm buying, say, university, I'm buying stationery, I've got my heating and lighting costs. I'm employing consultants, I'm employing lawyers and accountants, just like all businesses do. They're all charging you VAT. If you're not VAT registered, then you just have to take that on the chin.
If you do register for VAT,
you get to recoup the money.
Right. Okay. So it is a sort of business model in a way then. We'll be here all day if I keep trying to understand this. Craig Hall has our next question. That's a terrible thing for somebody who's hosting a finance pod to admit, isn't it? We'll be here all day until I understand this. But that's probably part of the charm of this pod, Kieran. Was that Findy coming in or BAFTA going out?
I think it was BAFTA going out.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Craig Hall says, we hear a lot about clubs taking the option to extend player contracts for, say, an extra year at the end of their main contract. Is this solely the club's option to activate, or does the player have to agree and sign?
When the initial contract is signed by the player, the club, and their representatives, all of the terminology has to be agreed. So that would be the potential option as well. From a club's perspective, the reason why clubs like options is that it protects the transfer value of a player. So if we take a look at the Paul Pogba situation, Paul Pogba signed for Manchester United in 2016. People might remember him as France's third best midfield player in Euro 2016. And therefore, that's why I paid a world record fee for him at the time. The advantage to the club is that if Paul Pogba was playing really well and he hadn't signed a contract extension himself, season 2021, the final year of a player's contract, we know that the value falls. By having that extension option and triggering that, it effectively says, well, a player who could leave in 12 months will now can't leave for 24 months, and that helps to bump up the value of the player transfer. At the same time, if the player has been an absolute disaster, and Paul Pogba wasn't, let's be honest here, he didn't rip up trees, he wasn't a disaster for Manchester United, it's expensive. If the player had been really poor, it saves the club committing itself to that final year of wages. So that's the position from the club's point of view. As far as the player is concerned, what will normally happen is that the contract option is normally linked to specific conditions. So it's, if you've played 20 matches in the season, then you effectively get an automatic rollover if you want to take that up. And that protects the player because he says, I've played well. Many players have got families, they've got financial commitments and so on. So it gives them a little bit of protection. It can work against the player, though. So, you and I, we both know in respect of clubs, where you say, well, why has he not played recently? He was in really good form, and it turns out that the player's got a clause in the contract, whereas he plays 30 games a season or 25 games a season. So he gets to 29. The club doesn't want to commit to a further year of wages. Yeah. So the manager is called into the offices of the chief executive and says, we don't want to go there with that player. I think there was a famous one at Leeds United involving Seth Johnson, from what I recall. So that's a real shame because ultimately you know, it's part of your professional career, and you're being denied the opportunity, which under normal circumstances, you know, you would be playing on merit due to financial arrangements and contracts. Mm.
Jake Doyle has a cunning mind, I think. He's also come up, I'm almost reluctant to ask this question because I might suggest to Jake that he saves this as a business idea. But Jake says, are there rules in place regarding the advertisement hoardings around the perimeter of the pitch? If so, what is to stop a company paying a premium to have their advert suddenly appear when the ball is in the final third? This would have their brand almost exclusively seen on highlight packages. That's a good idea, Kieran.
It is. And the thing is, Jake, for all we know, that might already be the case.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the marketing industry is doesn't tend to miss too many tricks. Mm. Yeah, we're already aware that the perimeter advertising that we physically see when we attend matches isn't necessarily what viewers see in different countries around the world. Mm. Because, you know, such is the capabilities of the broadcasting industry that you can now have, for domestic, you know, domestic viewers watching on Sky or BT Sport or Amazon, wherever it's going to be, you might have one set of adverts. But if you're watching in South Africa, if you're watching in Thailand, if you're watching in the States, you might be getting more tailored advertisements. And this is fantastic because it effectively allows the clubs and the marketing departments to get double bubble. Mm. Because, you know, who's going to who in the US is going to be interested in adverts for, you know, the post office or Worthington Ale or something like that? Not that's if Worthington Ale still exists. My knowledge of alcohol.
I'm not sure the post office is doing too much advertising around Old Trafford on a match day. Here and even come to that.
Well, having seen the price of a stamp recently, I can't understand.
Yes, I bloody have. It was a Tony Hancock moment. It's like, what, a pint?
Going back to Jake's position, I think this could be something that could be done, and especially, you know, if a goal is scored, then all of this, you know, you could have adverts coming around. Yeah, you know, this goal is sponsored by such and such. Mm. But remember, when it comes to advertising, for every winner, there's got to be a loser. So if somebody's prepared to pay a premium for the perimeter advertising where the ball is currently located, and yeah, we've seen the advancements that are being made with regards to this new sort of virtual reality augmented VAR proposals. So therefore, if you've got trackers in the ball, that could be easily linked to the perimeter advertising. But if I was a normal advertiser so my product's being advertised at the other end of the pitch where the ball's not going, there's going to be, you know, 30, 40, 60,000 pairs of eyes not looking at that advertising hoarding for the whole of the 90 minutes because everybody's following the ball. Mm. So you could see other advertisers saying, well, why do we bother? So I think we'd have to be a little bit cautious here about how this went through.
A couple of years ago, it took us quite some time to persuade a friend of ours that the NatWest advert on the pitch during a Lord's test wasn't actually on the pitch. It was only on the screen. At one stage, we thought we were going to have to take him to Lord's to show him that this was a miracle of the broadcast industry. And also,
Lord's a miracle. I like that.
I didn't really. It just pours off me like sweat, Kieran. We even pointed out to him because it was kind of like standing up. I said, the bowler's going to run into it if it's actually on the ground. But he just couldn't get his head around the fact that TV were able to impose these sort of logos. Johnny Foster, talking of Worthington's, from Worthington to Johnny Foster. I don't think Worthington's does exist anymore, Kieran, to be honest. I sure could. You could have a nice pint of mead instead. Mead's still going. You can get mead. Especially where I imagine Sussex is up to your eyeballs in mead where you are.
Oh, yes.
Johnny Foster says, how do arrangements for larger clubs such as Arsenal come about to use lower league grounds such as Boreham Wood to host their reserve games and ladies' teams? Is this a good source of income for the smaller clubs? And so is it worth their while to keep up with the maintenance to keep those grounds attractive? What sort of income would Boreham Wood, for example, get from this?
Right. I have looked at Boreham Wood's accounts. I suspect I was the only person at 8 a.m. on a Sunday morning going on to the company's house website. Okay, Boreham Wood Football Club. They don't actually show their rental income, but it was interesting to look at what Boreham Wood have been saying. I think Arsenal have paid them £100,000 as a contribution towards a new stand and also towards training rooms. So it's certainly beneficial from the club which is in receipt of the money. From the club which is hiring out, the likes of Arsenal, I think Chelsea, they paid around about – they paid money to – was it AFC Wimbledon? Around it was about £7 million for
King's Meadow.
King's Meadow.
Yeah.
So there are certainly benefits for the club in receipt from the club that's paying the money. They get somewhere where football can be played in a what you might call a proper football environment. Because if you've got an under 23 or an under 18 match which is taking place at the sort of the normal training facilities, first of all, it is literally being watched by two men and a dog, that's about as far as it goes, which isn't good, I think, for players' development. Because I've watched some under 23 games at the Amex, and there's not a big crowd there, but one or two stands are open, and there's a bit of atmosphere, and from the players' point of view, they get to play football in a football stadium, and that is part of the environment of their job. Mm. It also means that if you've got the under-18s or the under-23s playing and you've got the senior team and they're being coached, the last thing you want is eyes and ears from other clubs at your training facilities. It's separation of facilities, which I think there's some genuine benefits from. So as far as this is concerned, everybody's a winner. The groundsman at the main club Finley's just come in. I'd say that as a result of raging inflation, we're now having to use snide wonky chomps from Aldi instead of the regulars. They're going up in price so much.
Oh my God, you're joking.
This is the inflation spiral that people aren't talking about.
What are they, obviously they're not called wonky chomps. What are they? Winky chomps?
something with some very
wonky chomps.
Typical Aldi, but he seems happy enough. We've not told him. Yeah, we hide the wrappers.
Kieran, he's a clever dog, but I suspect he can't read quite yet. You need to hide the wrappers. I think that's more Gail, really. That's more the Baroness deciding that she doesn't really want Aldi stuff in the house, but needs must when the devil drives. Anyway, how did we get? We were in Boreham Wood a minute ago. Now we're
in Boreham Wood. Yes.
Now we're in Aldi buying Winky Chumps.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Why that email from BAFTA never comes to us? It's always been a conundrum for me.
We've run out of steam on that question. Should we move on to next one?
Yes. Let's.
Yeah. Apologies for that, Johnny. We were going so well, and then we got interrupted by a dog who can't read. We have three questions left. Ewan Morrison asked the first one. And again, it's about something that fascinates our listeners, which is why I'm always happy to try and clarify it again. And it's about kits, which again is why I'm always happy to ask the question. Ewan starts rather sadly by saying, according to my dad, I'm sad because I collect football shirts. Will you tell your dad that he's the sad one here, Ewan? You tell him to listen to this pod and we'll put your dad right. But Ewan says, at least I know I'm not the only one. Quite correct. Kieran, for example. Because you often hear fans discussing the value of certain kits they have due to age, iconic moments, etc. Now, my question is in regards to remakes. Score Draw, for example, is a company that remake these classic kits, and they seem very popular. During the Euros, for example, the 96 England and Scotland kits seemed as popular to wear as the current 2021 kit. My God, we have got a backlog of questions, haven't we? Holy mother. How does this work financially? There's obvious differences, for example, the lack of manufacturer logo. The design is the same. Is Score Draw paying a fee to Umbro to use it? Is it to the FA? And why wouldn't someone like Umbro just remake some of these old designs themselves when there appears to be a market for them? As I say, Kieran, this is a question that does come up on a periodic basis. But it indicates the fact that kits rather than amortization is what fans are kind of obsessed with. The economics of football kits is something we haven't really fully discussed because we haven't got time to do so. It's a specialist pod, but it does fascinate fans. And this idea of remaking old kits is something we get asked a lot.
Well, as far as Scoredraw is concerned, if you go onto their website, they say, you know, everything has been licensed. Right. So therefore they will have paid a fee to the club for the use of the club badge. Assuming that the likes of Umbro and Adidas and so on have some form of intellectual property deal. Now, that may have expired because intellectual property deals are normally fixed for a period of time. So that may have expired, but if it hasn't expired, again, they will have had to pay a license fee. I do remember Umbro itself selling nostalgia kits, especially during World Cup competitions. Mm. And then they seem to abandon it. And certainly Scoredraw, having looked at their website, appears to have really entered that market with a degree of enthusiasm. So it could be that from the perspective of Umbro, that the production runs, that they are used to big selling runs, they just felt that it wasn't worth it from their point of view, and they'll just pick up the license fee if there is one going from Scoredraw. Scoredraw might have suppliers who are willing to make 1,000 kits or 5,000 kits, and Umbro might have a minimum order number of 50,000, and they say, and also that they feel, why aren't we cannibalizing ourselves? Because I appreciate that Umbro, it was acquired by Nike, and I think then Nike went and sold it again. But from Nike's position, they say, if we're trying to sell the England 22 kit, why are we also trying to sell the 1996 one? Yeah, because if somebody people aren't going to buy both.
So we
end up doing more work for no extra money. And of course, we've got the extra costs incurred ourselves because we've got to have two contracts with suppliers and manufacturers and so on. So I suspect that's what it is. But I think that they're cheaper. I think it's £40 normally for a retro shirt. Nike, I think they're now selling the England kit. It's more than £70.
Yeah.
And then if you want the match authentic one, it's £115.
You know, judging by the way Finley just slammed that door, he may not be able to. He may not be able to read, but perhaps it seems he can hear because there's the mere mention of Aldi, and he was off. He's gone.
That's right.
Our penultimate question comes from Jonathan Bagley, and this is certainly an area we have not explored before. It's an interesting question. Jonathan Bagley says, "I've listened to every episode as soon as they've been released." That's very kind of you, Jonathan. Thank you. My question is about the food and drink provided to the press and broadcasters at matches. Who pays for this? If it's the club, what benefits do they get? As we know, most football clubs are losing money, so could do without this extra expense. I can add a bit of context here, Kieran, having spent a lot of time.
I have to say, this is your question, not mine.
I don't know the finances involved, obviously, but I can tell you there is a certain there is some Premier League clubs even at the lower end who will provide very nice pies and sandwiches, but they are pies and sandwiches. Whereas at the upper end, Arsenal, for example, supply a very, very extravagant hot buffet, to about 200 people. So some clubs will have separate canteens, for want of a better word, for photographers, for example, where things are more basic. But a club like Arsenal, and you're looking at about 200 people from around the world. It's not just local press people. It's people from around the world. Mm. Ex-players who are there, pundits. So there's a lot of people in these places. The West Ham one in the old stadium was very good as well. So they're catering for 200 people, probably from, if it's a 3 o'clock kickoff, from 10 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. So it must be some considerable expense. But I've got no idea who pays it, Kieran.
My understanding is that it is provided on a gratis basis by the clubs. You don't really want to annoy a journalist unless you have to. So, to say, here's your lunch, or we're charging you £2 for a cup of tea and £4 for a pie and so on, that's just going to cause unnecessary resentment because – let's face it, there are many occasions during the year when the club will want that journalist to say something positive. I've been fortunate enough to be to sort of been invited to a few club affairs and invited into the press room and so on. And it's always been provided on a free basis. Yeah. I would be very surprised if the clubs would go down that particular route, because there is a symbiotic relationship between football and the media, that they need each other. They both provide benefits for each other. Why poke the bear unnecessarily especially if one club breaks ranks and it gets known as the only club in the Premier League to charge for drinks and food, then subconsciously you're going to have that at the back of your mind when you're doing your copy.
I believe Simon Jordan tried to do that. It didn't last long as an experiment. Right. Now, they're always free, these press rooms, but it'd be interesting if anybody from Arsenal was listening to this. I wonder if they could give us a ballpark figure, because it must be 10,000, 20,000. Somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000. That's going to be my guess. The pecking order in press rooms is really interesting.
Absolutely.
I think I was at Blackburn. So I was always very excited to go into press rooms. It was fascinating. Mm. You meet some really interesting people, and you get free food, which is great. but it's very much. I remember there was like three chairs, three laptops available in like a sort of prime position, and I asked somebody why nobody was sitting there already, because the rest of the place was crowded. And they're the red tops. They're the tabloid seats. They are.
Oh, right.
It's very much local radio, local press at the bottom, then the Independent and the Guardian, and then the tabloid guys come swaggering in like extras in a Guy Ritchie film. They're really the governors. It's very, don't touch Martin Samuel's pie, whatever you do. I think it's fairly obvious that no one does touch Martin Samuel's pies, but there you are. He's a very good journalist. he's a very good journalist. Very good journalist. But they do defer to the. Well, it's the same in the pecking. That's the pecking order afterwards. They speak to the TV first, and then it's the tabloid journalist, and then the poor old radio journalist. About 2 hours later, still waiting for those crumbs from the table, as you say. Our last question comes from Jay Smith. And Jay says, with the investment in Wakefield from the new American investment firm and looking at what Red Bull did in Germany, can you see other wealthy investment firms buying lower-level league clubs in areas with big potential like Wakefield to build them up with big investment to get them climbing the leagues the way Leipzig did in Germany?
I think this is a cracking question. Mm. And I think we had this question on the... on the quiz, which is the biggest city in the country without a football team.
Yeah, which came as a surprise to most people, I think.
Yeah. Wakefield has a population of 340,000 people. Mm. Brighton's got a population of 290,000.
Mm. They make a lot of noise, though, don't they? So it sounds bigger.
Well, synchronised tutting. Yeah, it's an art.
The price of this quinoa.
We are seeing increased interest in football from investment groups. They genuinely believe that it is undervalued. Mm. They genuinely believe that the broadcast rights can be expanded, especially on a global basis. So there is a lot of logic to what Jay has said, because what you don't want to do is to buy a football club in an area which is ultimately a relatively small catchment, because that puts an automatic ceiling on the opportunities and ambitions of the club. I think it's a good call out by him. You can see the benefits, certainly what Red Bull have done. It's been expensive for Red Bull, but they would always argue that the publicity that gets them, because and I know it's RB Leipzig, but we know what RB stands for.
Yeah,
it's not the wording which is used by the club necessarily.
Although it was quite controversial when Red Bull did that in Germany, that's something that investors here wouldn't have to overcome, would it? In existing rules about big investors taking over clubs like they had in Germany, which Red Bull seemed to break. I mean, here, buying a club like Wakefield would seem to be fairly low risk, low expenditure, but with a huge chance of success.
Yeah, there's a very big upside, and until the fan-led review goes through, and we get and also an independent regulator wouldn't probably go down to that level of football.
Interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. Thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. It's very kind of you. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod as well, then please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, as always, folks, thank you so much for your support for the show. We are genuinely grateful, and you know, the feedback whilst we laugh at ourselves in terms of the huge backlog of emails that we've not got round to answering on the Sunday show. We appreciate the fact that you genuinely care about the game so much that you send them in, and we will get around to them even if we stop doing the regular show one day. Yeah, when football is being cleaned up so much that there's no need for us to have a new show, we'll just double up the numbers of the Sunday show. If you want to support the show, that's great through Patreon. But there's other ways in which you can do that, and that's to go on to your podcast app and give us a review, and even give us 5 stars. It helps. It doesn't matter what you say. If you want to write a review, you could even say you'd rather have the show presented by Macho Man Randy Savage and Tory MP Chris Pincher. We wouldn't care. We wouldn't bother us. I'm not saying which of those I'd most like to see, but yeah, that's the way it goes.
Oh, that's going to worry Guy, that one. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.